Football, that distinctly American game, grew up in a gritty place far from the big cities. A place of smokestacks and cornfields. No place has a superior claim to fathering this most grueling of games than Ohio's Stark County. It is not the grand stage of professional football that birthed the game here, but a simple high school rivalry. The neighboring towns from which they came and for which they committed themselves to four quarters of combat. In the beginning, and even today, it is a thing of purity, less about glory than honor. The towns of Canton and Massillon have vied with each other for generations, begrudgingly exchanging the crown of victor, giving their rivals hell, and swearing each season to avenge the loss.
Welcome to Good Seats Still Available, a curious little podcast devoted to exploring what used to be in professional sports. Here's your host, Tim Hanlon.
Hello there, friends. Your pal Tim Hanlon is here reporting for duty. How are you? It's Good Seats Still Available, the curious little podcast that is devoted to what used to be in the realm of professional sports. And of course, as always, we thank you for joining us for the festivities, which this week takes us back to the gridiron and aptly timed, given the NFL football season now officially underway with the regular season. Hope you enjoyed the games and didn't bet too heavily and in the negative direction, but hopefully a couple of good outcomes for your favorite team or situations. We go back to the origins of this great sport known as football, professional football, American football, and the National Football League version of such, and all that's come from it. And we've talked about a lot of historical twists and turns of various teams and the league itself and its formation and all that kind of stuff. But I think a lot of people get lost in the fact that there were lots of things going on in the frisky years before the founding of, and frankly, relatively shaky founding of the National Football League in 1920. Lord knows it wasn't even called the NFL in 1920. It took a couple of years to even finally adopt that name. But our guest this week, Greg Fusari, has an absolutely not only excellent book out called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. The subtitle kind of hints it, as I think, to its importance. It is literally the volume that needs to precede anything that happened from 1920 onward in the storytelling of professional football in this country. This book, Gridiron Legacy, talks about exquisitely and accessibly great photos, very good writing, good journalism, great stories, personal photography from Greg's family, and as you'll hear in our conversation, his great-grandfather, a very central element of this story, and frankly, the gate that was opened, the portal, if you will, for Greg's investigation of this very rich series of stories, pieces of fabric, if you will, in the preliminary quilt that was professional football before the boys assembled in Canton to figure out a national, if you will, football league. We put national in quotes because obviously it was very regional at the time still in the Midwest and the Northeast. But Greg's great-grandfather, a guy by the name of Bob Shearing, is an essential part of this. And the story of professional football very much centers in the state of Pennsylvania and environs, and Ohio makes an appearance. And as that clip sort of hints, some of the pieces of that origin story from the late 1800s, early 1900s, still reverberate and live on today. In the case of that clip, two teams that we'll hear in our conversation with Greg coming up were elemental in those early professional days, and to a fault, in 1906, and yes, you need to listen to the episode to find out why, professional football arguably, or maybe not so arguably, came to a sudden halt because of the shenanigans between the two teams aforementioned, the Canton Bulldogs, now known high school-wise as the McKinley-Canton Bulldogs, and the Massillon Tigers, which still exist in their high school form as of today. That legacy continues in the perhaps it's a bitter rivalry for sure at high school. Some would even call it, especially in Ohio, the greatest football rivalry in America. Now, that's saying something, and maybe there are people who would fight you on that. But that is part of the legacy, these high school teams and these towns which don't like each other. It all dates back to what was going on in the early aughts, 1900 aughts, between those two cities doing professional football against themselves. And that is just but one of the major stories and through lines for this great book called Gridiron Legacy. As we discuss this week with our guest, Greg Fisseri, our investigation, our interest, our intrigue behind the story of the NFL in the years prior to its founding in 1920, professional football, the origin story of the great game that we know and love today. We're going to just get right to that conversation. And I just want to call out the book again. It's called Gridiron Legacy. It is available wherever fine books are found. You can get it at our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com by searching up this episode number 317 with Greg Fisseri, and you will be whisked away to Amazon, and we'll get a couple of shekels of referral love, and you will get the book in all its gorgeous 300 and some pages long, richly photographed and substantially sized goodness coming your way. You could also go to gridironlegacy.com and get yourself a copy directly from Greg, and he will do you one better. Besides not only selling you a copy of the book directly, he'll also sign or provide a signature of the book as well before he ships it off to you. So two great ways to get the book. Just by all means, I highly recommend it. If you are a football fan of any kind and have any interest, any whiff of curiosity about what pro football was before it became pro football, run, don't walk to get a copy of this book, Gridiron Legacy. But let the conversation do the selling, and let's get to that conversation now, shall we? Here is our chat that we had with Greg Fisseri about a few days ago, and it's a fascinating tale, and I think you'll enjoy it. I hope you do. Please, as always, enjoy. I am ecstatic to talk to you because I actually heard your dulcet tones on WBBM News Radio here in Chicago the other day, doing an interview for the book and stuff. So it's clear that this book and what you have written about, and maybe I would argue obsessed about for the last number of years, is really resonating. But before we kind of get into the origin story, why don't you give our audience a bit of a sense of who you are and the day job kind of thing, and then how perhaps the whole notion of pre-NFL professional football became such a, I don't know, an obsession for you.
Yeah, so good question. Who I am? Who am I? I'm a son of Pittsburgh, basically. And so that's where all this started. And Pittsburgh, obviously, steel city, very industrial town. Going back into the, you know, our youth, 60s, 70s, first era of Steelers success, football became a real passion there after being, you know, even the NFL being sort of a under the radar league for decades. So pro football, the NFL just started becoming prominent, and simultaneously, you know, Pittsburgh had even more so back then, sort of a inferiority complex a little bit to the big cities of New York and Philadelphia that they competed with in sports, and still the Pirates, you know, they can't afford to compete with the budgets of bigger cities and try to get by on lower lower budgets, but nonetheless, the Pirates and the Steelers were having huge success then. City of Champions, World Series in 71, 79, four Super Bowls. Even Pitt won a national championship with Tony Dorsett before he was Dorsett in 76. And it was great. You know, what a great time to be growing up there. So while I'm hanging out at my grandmother's home sometimes in this little industrial suburb about 10 miles east of the city called Wilmerding. I mean, what even the name sounds old. And it was right next to Turtle Creek in the sort of Monongahela Valley. So it was a Westinghouse community. It was built around the Westinghouse Air Brake Company, and several of my older relatives worked there. So at my grandmother's home in Wilmerding, they had one, probably the nicest home in Wilmerding, which built in 1898. It was, you know, nothing much by today's standards, but still at the time they had a finished basement, which was different than most people's cellars back there, old dusty, you know, grimy cellars. So a finished basement with a pool table and a television. And so like they were something a little bit of a cut above in their community. And what I came to understand was that the patriarch of the family, my great-grandfather, Bob Shiring, was the fellow that sort of created all this. And it all started with his reputation as a great professional football player before the NFL, first in Pittsburgh and then in Massillon, Ohio, a little town right adjacent to Canton, where the Pro Football Hall of Fame is. So to add some spice and some intrigue to his lore and legacy, there were three large framed team photos of his professional teams, one from Pittsburgh, two from Massillon, on the wall in this billiard room. And they were fascinating to me. You're like old, you know, they were probably in their 20s, but they looked like they were in their 40s, like hardened, you know, tough men. No. And so this is, as my grandma said, the stock from which I was made. And she had little stories about his pro football exploits, and but not much of a complete narrative, but enough to make it, you know, resonate with me. And she even showed me a football history book that was done in the 70s, similar to what I've done now, you know, with what was available at the time. All in black and white then, but it included a few of the same team pictures. So I'm like, she wasn't really exaggerating. You know, this was a real part of pro football history. So that's sort of who I was, and from that I was blessed with, you know, an up and coming family that moved to the, you know, newer suburbs of Pittsburgh nearby, and got an opportunity to get a nice private school education. Even play a little ice hockey, you know, as a kid, trained by one of the Penguins, and play a lot of competitive tennis. So sports then, you know, sort of became my avenue, was to, along with my education, to keep the, you know, the American dream going. And I ended up going to Georgetown in the 80s when Patrick Ewing was there. You and I have this in common. And the end of Patrick, the beginning of Dikembe and Alonzo Mourning, and continuing my, you know, starting my business career in D.C. And so I've never lived in Pittsburgh again. I met my wife there in D.C. in the mid-90s, and ended up getting an MBA while working in D.C., and she and I moved to Atlanta in 96, which was the Olympic year, and lived there ever since until recently. We became empty nesters last year and bought a beach house in the Florida Panhandle. So life is good, but with the freedom of starting my own company in 2011, I was able to start researching this football history some more. Which was originally just a genealogy project, but it grew into something that the Hall of Fame got behind, and eventually this book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's missing origin story about my great grandfather's role, key role in little did I know, in the pre-NFL era.
So Bob Schering obviously plays an outsized role sort of in this book, but I must tell you this book is it's a revelation to me, and I'm not sort of a Coffin Corner Pro Football Research Association, you know, guy per se, right? I mean, we've had plenty of folks in that group, that organization, on the show in the past, and you know, I am not sort of like the historian's historian on this kind of stuff, but the manner in which this book has been created and plays out is very accessible, right? If you're a football fan, just generally, or just a current sports fan or a current NFL fan, this book is very approachable, right? It's I wouldn't call it coffee table per se, because I think that undersells it a bit, because there's a lot of depth and content in here, but it is presented in a very visually appealing and accessible way. And I got to tell you, I'm floored by just how much stuff is in this period of time prior to 1920. I think most people, just because their heads will hurt, just think that the NFL just kind of just showed up one day, you know, tablets on the mount, and all was good from there. But Lord knows you have proven that there is absolutely a whole bunch of tributaries that were a predecessor to all of that in 1920.
Thanks. Yeah, you really said a mouthful there, and you touched on a lot of very good points and a lot to unpack, as they say. So, right. If anyone finds themselves in life with an opportunity to do something, you know, significant, I mean, in any way that hasn't been done before. And these days it feels like there's so few things that really haven't been done or researched or that you can't find online. And all of a sudden I'm sitting there in 2007 after my grandmother passed away, having discovered one of those fun kind of stories where you discover a treasure in your attic or your grandma's, you know, house or something. And that's what I did. I mean, I found this collection of pre-NFL photos from my great-grandfather's career that I instantly knew was special and had to dig in and learn more about them, find out what they represented and who they were. And that's what led me to first discover, you know, my first Google search was discovering the Pro Football Researchers Association and that Coffin Corner publication you mentioned, which was founded by a fellow named Bob Carroll, it turns out, from Pittsburgh in 1979. And I got him just before the end of his life, and he was well enough to help me, sort of like a mentor, like a, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi sort of guy. Who was very close to Joe Horrigan, who was the executive director at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and worked on who was also a big part of the group of founding PFRA members back then. And he said, "You need to go see Joe." He said, "What you have here is unbelievable," and they would be floored. So that was sort of the first step. So I'm not really part of that. I wasn't part of that culture in a history geek, for lack of a better word, by nature, but I've certainly bonded with those people and have become part of that group, just attended that conference, which happened to be in Pittsburgh this year, a couple months ago. And they're very interesting people, but despite all that, they go down these rabbit holes, like, you know, a presentation on the Pottsville Maroons or the Frankfurt Yellow, you know, but the big picture of the whole pre-NFL era and how the game started, sort of like the book of Genesis, is missing from everything. And so I find myself with these photos, and that leads the people at the Hall of Fame to encourage me to dig in and flesh out the whole narrative of that period to accompany the photos in a book. And as you said, I didn't want to write the book either. I'm not an author by trade, and I tried to go out and find a professional you know, start at the top. You know, I tried Michael Lewis from The Blind Side and Laura Hillenbrand from Seabiscuit and, you know, couldn't get any takers. Worked my way down to some sports writers in Pittsburgh, and that didn't kind of pan out. And eventually a publisher just said, look, I love it. I'll do it. But I want you to write it, only if you write it, because I want your expertise and passion and heart in it. And I'm like, oh boy, you know, I can write a good history paper, but I don't know if I can write something interesting and entertaining. And so that was really the challenge of becoming a writer was, and I appreciate so much you saying it's accessible, because I tried to write it in a accessible sort of lighthearted way with lots of original quotes from newspapers and entertaining, you know, colorful images of ticket stubs and equipment and programs and pennants and things to go with the old black and white pictures. But it was something that had never been done. And they said, you are in a unique, only you can do this project in such a way that nobody else can, with the photos from the family and your family connection to it and all of the research you've done, plus what you've discovered in your research, which explains and solves the cold case of the game fixing scandal that caused that, ultimately was the reason this whole story had been lost.
We'll get to that, and I want to get to that in a minute because that's clearly a pivotal point. But a couple of threads here. So number one, I mean, frankly, it's almost a happy accident that you were born and raised in Pennsylvania, right? And happened to have been part of a family that included an early pro football player in that process, because as we discover in this book, right, a whole lot, maybe almost, I want to say, exclusively for a period of time, of this origin story of professional football really was housed and in the state of Pennsylvania. I mean, you could not have been in a more cosmic environment for, you know, potential for those seeds to be sown.
Right. And little did I know that. If you ask the most avid pro football fan, including or player, people that are in the Hall of Fame, and I've met and spoken to them and had fun conversing about why the Hall of Fame is in Canton, Ohio. I mean, at one point I met Troy Aikman, who's, you know, in the Hall of Fame, won 3 Super Bowls, broadcasts every week, including the Hall of Fame game. And when I met him, he said he had just come from Canton. I said, well, that's interesting. I'm working on this project with them. And I said, so why is the Hall of Fame there, Troy? And he's like, well, like everybody else, the best guess is, well, pro football started there, right? I'm like, no, actually it didn't. He's like, what do you mean? I said, well, where did it start? I said, Pittsburgh. And he said, how's that? And tell me, you know. So that gets people's attention right away if they realize, like pretty much everybody does it, they don't know. And they want to know. They should know. So he says, then they want to know and they tell me. So I've got his attention and I can, you know, start explaining how, you know, college football in the starting 1869, Princeton Rutgers, first college football game, begets amateur adult football for a couple decades. And then primarily in Pittsburgh, where there's a lot of money from the Industrial Revolution, steel, coal, etc., and form, you know, the companies sponsor amateur athletic clubs to give employees and people recreation on the weekends. And the competition and rivalries build to the point where the best former college players come to the area and they get soft compensation at first so their teams can stay in the AAU sports and for the clubs and other sports, because if you got caught paying cash to anybody, your whole club is out of the AAU. So they get memberships and jobs and watches and things like that to play. And eventually somebody gets paid cash, right, under the table. So 1892, it turns out, according to an accounting ledger that surfaces in the 1960s when the Hall of Fame opens, The Allegheny Athletic Association in Pittsburgh paid a guy named William Pudge Heffelfinger, an All-American from Yale, $500 cash, which is a huge amount, then for one game to beat their rival Pittsburgh Athletic Club, which he did on a scoop and score for 4 points. And so that accounting ledger is called the Birth Certificate of Pro Football. It lives in the Hall of Fame in their rotunda in the first exhibit, which is a timeline with something that I discovered on my journey to accompany it that I don't want to spoil, but it's in the book. So that's how pro football started. And that just starts blowing people's minds that, look, there's 28 years of pro football before the NFL was founded in Canton in 1920, which is why the Hall of Fame is there, because the NFL was founded there, not because pro football started there.
Well, and that leads me to a second thread, which is what of the NFL? Because I would argue, you know, there's a little bit of hagiography, perhaps, that's more convenient to the National Football League. I don't know, frankly, how much the NFL particularly cares about the 1920s and 1930s. I mean, they certainly tip the hat towards it, how many years it's been around and stuff, right? But not unlike the NHL, right? People think the original six were the original six. And of course, that's not the case once you scratch the surface. Now, the NHL doesn't go out of its way to re-educate or remind people that there was a history of the NHL before the original, quote-unquote, original six. And it doesn't seem to me that the NFL particularly cares if people think that, you know George Halas and the guys in the room in 1920 and or, you know, didn't even create the term National Football League until 3 years after that, right? So
right. It
doesn't – it almost feels like there's no real sort of, I don't know, care that the NFL really kind of has. And maybe the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I don't know, maybe kind of has to kind of go – I don't know. Nobody seems to kind of want to set the record straight, so to speak, maybe until you've come along.
Yes and yes. I think there's two – component. First of all, nobody has any attention span these days. And so, you know, did people even care about the Bible, right? I mean, it's just, it explains everything. So there needed to be sort of a book of Genesis of pro football. And whether people want to read it or not, I wrote it. So it's there for anybody who cares. So a lot of people don't want to spend the time to care. They don't care, or they didn't know. So, I mean, I literally discovered a lot of things that were unknown and connected so many dots just because of my passion and persistence to dig for things that were there. But, no, I mean, just right under everybody's nose for 100+ years.
Yeah, let me throw a couple at you, for example. I mean, like there was actually something, and I learned this through your book. I mean, there was something actually called the National Football League in, what was it, 1902 or so. Or at least the name was bandied about. And it was interesting because it was, and we've seen this in our conversations about early soccer in this country, professional soccer, Major League Baseball owners were kind of, at the time, part of sort of trying to stand that up. And that actually was part of the mix in the early NFL days, like Brooklyn Dodgers and stuff in the 30s and 40s as well. That fascinating to me, as is... hugely fascinating to me, indoor football around in 1902, at least to start in Madison Square Garden. I mean, tell us about those two things and the World Series of pro football. I mean, those things are fascinating to me. And this is 20 years prior to the NFL.
Right. So there was certainly baseball was there, professional baseball. And so there was a model and some examples and people in the pro sports community that could be sought. And it turned out, especially in Philadelphia, even though the game was being played in Pittsburgh predominantly, and they played in the Pirates parks and things like that. But and one of the Pirates owners, I think it was William Chase Temple, became allegedly one of the first pro football owners of this team called Homestead in Pittsburgh around 1900, 1901. But So some of the people that were in baseball or connected to the people in baseball saw football, if they had frustrations with baseball, as something new to try. They're entrepreneurial. So there was this special character in the book named Blondie Wallace, who was an All-American player at Penn and in 1901. And he didn't quite graduate, even though he was going to be captain his senior year. He had some issues with his grades and money, and so he sort of dropped out. But without many other options, perhaps, he sought Connie Mack, who was the Philadelphia Athletics baseball manager, for support to start the first pro football team in Philadelphia. So Mack did, and later said he lost his shirt on the venture, but that football team was also called the Athletics, similar to how the first Pittsburgh Steelers were first called the Pirates in the 30s when they came into the NFL. They usually played in the same parks, and there's just connections. People related to the names, I guess, while they were starting out. So some
of the players too, right? I mean, you go to a pretty good lengths to talk about how Bob Schiering, your great grandfather, played alongside Christy Mathewson, a name that most baseball historians know very well as a Hall of Famer and then some.
Christy Matthews, yeah, exactly, and then some. He was a national icon. They revered as the Christian gentleman when a lot of the baseball players were sort of more like sort of roughnecks, and he was such a classy guy and still thought of as one of the top three pitchers of all time, up there with Walter Johnson and whoever else. So Mathewson had played college football at Bucknell as well, and before he became a star in Major League Baseball, but he was still playing baseball with the Brooklyn Dodgers, I believe, or New York. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on which team. New York Giants it was, because he threw three shutouts in the 1905 World Series.
Yep.
They won. So just before that, when he was young in his baseball career and still could finagle, playing some football while risking injury, he did play in the 1902 Pittsburgh professional team with my great grandfather. Very cool team picture in the book of them next to each other in that team photo. And my grandmother told me, even she was so proud of that her story was that Mathewson said he'd only play on that team if my great grandfather was there to block for him as the center on the line, because he was a running back. So he would be less likely to get hurt and ruin his baseball career. So shortly after that, he became a star and didn't play any more pro football the next year. But that was also the last year of pro football in Pittsburgh. After a decade of trying from 1892 to 1902, it just wasn't making money. No team had ever made a profit. So they just kind of all folded up, and it seemed like it was going to die, the professional business model, until the Maslin Tigers amateur team in Ohio decided to import my great-grandfather and three of his teammates from Pittsburgh in 1903 to help win the Ohio State Championship, which they did by beating Akron in a very close game. And then it sort of took off from there in Ohio when all the other teams responded. And that's how it all went forward until the fateful 1906 season.
Alrighty, what is this? DraftKings Sportsbook. Hey, football is back in full swing with another week of epic games. And who's got you covered on the action for every single one of them? Well, of course, it's DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL, mind you. New customers can bet $5 on football and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. In fact, nobody's missing out on all the action this season. All DraftKings customers can take advantage of two new offers every game day this September. Get in on the NFL Week 2 action with DraftKings Sportsbook. Download the app now and use code GOODSEATS to sign up. New customers can bet just $5 and take home $200 instantly in bonus bets. Only on DraftKings Sportsbook with that code GOODSEATS. DraftKings Sportsbook, the crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling by calling 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, Kansas, 21 plus of age, varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. See dkng.co/football for eligibility terms and responsible gaming resources. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. Eligibility and deposit restrictions apply. Now, back to our conversation. You mentioned Pennsylvania. You mentioned Ohio. There's a New York thread there with, you know, with Madison Square Garden and a New York Pro Championship in this process. I think one of the things that I sort of gleaned from this book pretty early is that there was a lot of, I guess for lack of a better word, regionalism, and more specifically in the Midwest and or Northeast. And that frankly, pro football was, I guess, a kind of a hodgepodge of, I guess you'd call it professional circuits that were sort of regionally centered. Do I have that right? And if so, were people kind of trying to thread together those sort of regional things into something potentially bigger, or was that not on anybody's radars really?
Yeah, I guess to tie in your question about the indoor football in Madison Square Garden, I think these guys basically just followed the money, you know, for a while. When it was not their full-time gigs, probably, you know, they all had other jobs, or at least most likely, and whether it was baseball also or other, you know, industry or business jobs, you know, they would play in. They couldn't play in Pittsburgh. You know, a center popped up in Philadelphia. And then they were entrepreneurial. They were willing to, you know, play in New York if big money people in New York offered an opportunity to come up and play in this holiday football festival with several college and high school games all in this 70-ish yard field in the garden for a weekend. They would try that, but it wasn't really an ongoing thing there in New York City. And they tried that for 2 years. It didn't make any money either. Some good humorous, you know, anecdotes that came out of that. The lights breaking, you know, with a punted ball and glass on the field and stuff.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall there, that must have been just something.
Yeah, and I managed to track down a program from one of those games in the book as well. So I've had a heck of a lot of fun tracking down, you know, memorabilia and from that period of time. It's just a little niche that I enjoy. So, you know, when it wasn't working in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or New York, you know, Ohio, you know, there was money there and a lot of industry and that was willing to take another chance because they hadn't experienced it yet. And maybe they thought they could do it better, but rivalry is really what spurs, you know, this innovation and the rivalry between Massillon, this little gem of a town, in Eastern Ohio, right next to Canton, that they have this intense rivalry that still burns today, and largely because of the issues that happened in this initial professional football period that got so contentious. The rivalries created there led them to be willing to support professional football just for the glory of beating their neighbors, basically, and trying to make money while doing it, whether legitimately through selling newspapers and tickets, which kind of fed each other. This another main character named E.J. Stewart was the initial Massillon amateur quarterback, who was also the sports editor for the Massillon paper, who was also the new team manager after he recruited better players to replace himself. So he basically stirred the pot in this rivalry and got Massillon people to hate Canton and vice versa to sell more papers and more tickets. So it's kind of how it all started, but it worked. Maybe not for the mental health of everybody in those towns, but they still hate each other and they don't really know why. And I had fun going to speak at the Massillon High School when these two schools, Massillon and Canton, they maintain the Tigers and Bulldogs names from those pro teams. And they don't even really appreciate that. Maybe some of them know that, but they don't know the details of what sparked this Hatfield-McCoy kind of situation there for over a century. So it was fun to speak at the Massillon High School last year, the Thursday before the big rivalry game, to explain the origin of it all to them. I'm sort of like a second son to in Massillon.
All right. Well, without sort of giving it away, maybe you can just put 1906, the season and what transpired, kind of in a bit of context, because it's pretty clear in this book that the what went down that season essentially chilled any real growth into full-fledged national, if you will, professionalism of the sport for at least, you know, a decade. And the seeds then, you know, not being picked up until maybe the latter part of the teens when 1920 sort of circled around. So what kind of, you know, to the layman, what happened that from that rivalry that maybe put the kibosh on it for a number of years and set professionalism back?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So as I said, 1903 was the year that the four ringers, including my great-grandfather, came out to Massillon, and they snuck out the state championship with these sort of unidentified players in the last game against Akron. And then, so Akron figured out, you know, everybody kind of figured out what had happened, and they started bringing in, you know, more players and being willing to pay players. Canton sat out the 04 season, at least professionally. That didn't mean they didn't play, I think, because the pro team still played a mixed schedule of colleges and other amateur teams. But after getting beat by Massillon again, which was just unacceptable, you know, they finally got in the pro game in 1905 and, you know, built a strong, very strong team of ex-college stars, and as did Akron and some others. And but still Massillon won in 04, like dominated. And in 05, a couple things happened. So the Canton captain, a fellow named Bill Laub, L-A-U-B, got hurt halfway or toward the end of the season. And so they needed a new captain, you know, leader. And it dawned on them that they should go to Philadelphia and recruit Blondie Wallace, who was the captain of the Philadelphia pro teams that rivaled the Pittsburgh teams that was captained by my great-grandfather, to sort of, you know, bring that rivalry west. And he was sort of like the Bill Parcells of his time, and said, I'll come, but only if I get control of the roster and can bring my own guys, and I'll guarantee a championship, right? So he comes, and he tries to cobble together, you know, a comparable team right before the end of the season, but he can't quite pull it off. So he fails in his guarantee, and, you know, he helped coach the national champions at Penn in 1904, and, you know, All-American. He sort of took a shot to his ego, but he's a really underestimated, you know, underappreciated character in the history of the sport, because in addition to helping start the first pro team in Philadelphia, he also he couldn't get the support of the Canton club after losing money again in 05 to do it again in 06. And he's like, look, I'll do it. You know, I'll take financial responsibility. Just give me the field and the name. So they said, fine, just give us 10% or whatever. So he took full, no team had ever made money, you know, and he's willing to do this on his own dime as a, you know, and he couldn't even pay to, you know, for his senior year at Penn. So huge risk, but he builds, you know, it becomes like a nuclear war as he recruits, you know, what looks on the field to be the best compilation of stars ever assembled. But they had never really played together. And meanwhile, Maslin had played together mostly a more quote unquote Western team from Western Pennsylvania in Western colleges and more blue collar, more of a team concept than these all-stars from the Ivy League and Penn that Wallace had assembled. So the cultural rivalry was really one interesting thing, sort of more the elites against the blue collar crowd. And the blue collar teamwork aspect always seemed to prevail, no matter in the end, no matter what happened. But the animosity that developed between Stewart on the Maslin side and Wallace as they negotiated for players, stole players from each other, negotiated financial terms of the games, how many games, where, when, it just became extremely contentious and unfriendly, and you know, between them, and to the point where they really actually hated each other by the end. And so they finally agreed to a 2-game championship series and a home and home series in which Canton would get the first game and Maslin as the defending champion would get the last game, and kind of like boxing, whoever wins the last game is really the champion. So they didn't really need a third game. But as things played out, their rumors started to force a third game to make more money, you know, sell more tickets, more paper, you know, newspapers, etc. And so rumors started getting out that the first two were going to be fixed and that they would split them intentionally. And there was proactive denials by the newspapers, even my great-grandfather, calling this nonsense publicly. But when the two games were played and they did split them, Canton winning at home and Maslin winning 2 weeks later at home, it seemed too convenient. And with the influence of gambling all around sports anyway, whether it was baseball or football, gamblers known to be on the sidelines watching practices, players talking about point spreads and betting on their own teams in the papers, it wasn't uncommon or unacceptable. It was almost expected and believable that the games were fixed. So the legendary story was that there was in the bar after the second game in Canton, in the bar in Canton after the game in Maslin that the Tigers won, fans were upset because they would always bet on their home team, and they stood up and screamed at the players in the bar, I think these games were fixed. The players were not in the mood. They weren't having it. They responded, no, they weren't. And a brawl breaks out, and literally somebody got thrown through the glass window of the bar in the hotel, just like in a Burt Reynolds movie. So after this incident, the next day, people wanted answers, and the newspapers had to respond. And so the Maslin newspaper, which again had the sports editor of the former Maslin quarterback and current team manager, writes a full front page headline story, title of which said, "Their Honor Inviolate," which means they did not violate their honor, denying that there was any actual fix, but admitting that there was an attempted bribe by one of their own players who offered a pool of $50,000, which is well over $1 million today, to my great-grandfather and one of his teammates, Bob Tiny Maxwell, who the Maxwell Player of the Year Award is named after today, very few people know, to get their teammates to fix the game, the two games. And but the article states what the story I heard from my grandmother, which was my great grandfather would not do it. He wouldn't take the bribe. And he was known to be for that, you know, from that to be a good guy and, you know, a man of honor and character. But, and that followed him throughout his life to his benefit and the benefit of our family down the road. But conversely, Blondie Wallace was thrown under the bus by the story, and for right or wrong, true or false, accusing him of being complicit in this scheme. And so this is what really sparked the fire that has never died, because Blount Wallace denied it, and even the player, a fellow named Walter East, who was the Maslin player that had the gambling connections and offered the money and was kicked off the team before those games because of that, when the bribe was reported by my great-grandfather, he came out and said, yeah, I did it. What are you going to do? He said, I fixed a college football game when I was at Pitt. I fixed baseball games when I managed the Akron team, minor league team, you know, so what? And he later denied it, but that was attributed to him. And but he said, Wallace, leave him alone. He didn't have anything to do. He wasn't involved. So Wallace fought legally, sued the Maslin paper and team for libel, but didn't have as much money. He was behind on his payments to his own players, again, losing money during the season for, you know, just paying too much to build a championship team, or so he thought. And so he could never clear his name, eventually running out of money. But people said, well, you know, he was sort of presumed guilty before he could prove his innocence, because of his reputation as sort of a rabble rouser, playing on the edges, stealing players from Maslin, not graduating from college, different things. So he was a bad guy. He probably knew he was guilty, or they paid him off. And he mysteriously disappears without a statement after he drops his case. And so he goes down in history as sort of a villain. And pro football dies after that because of people's suspicions that the game is not on the up and up. And that's why there was basically no pro football for 10 years until the folks in Canton decided to try again and started version 2 of the Canton Bulldogs in 1915, when they recruited Jim Thorpe, the world's greatest athlete after the 1912 Olympics, who played college football at the Carlisle School, Native American Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And they said, if Thorpe comes to play, people will want to come and see him play, and this will take off again. And it did exactly that. People loved Jim Thorpe, an icon on the level of Christy Mathewson or greater. And people showed up in thousands to see him and fell in love with pro football again, leading to the 14 team owners across the Midwest in 1920 to get together to form this new league that became the NFL, and 2 years later in name, first called the American Pro Football Association. But they needed some standardization of rules and to get them all on the same page, and that's why the league was founded. But in my opinion, it was the fallout from the scandal that caused the story and of the pre-NFL era to be lost, and so with was the legacy of these heroes and pioneers of the game that braved so many challenges to establish its foothold, and they really deserve, you know, to be honored and recognized. And I guess my book, in a large sense, was done to do that.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to double click per se on that, but it's clear that betting scandal and all of that certainly, in many respects, both simultaneously represented sort of the apex, I think, perhaps of budding professionalism and the rivalry and the interest and the newspapers and the coverage and all that kind of stuff, yet also was the early warning signal of, you know, something that, you know, people in early baseball were fearful of, and that was sort of professionalizing and the rogue element of gambling and all that kind of stuff that kind of put the kibosh on it for, or at least set it back for a period of time. Isn't it ironic, though? And I wonder, given all of your research over the last number of years and getting this book finally out and out into the world and stuff and the personal part of that story, right? That gambling has been loosened, shall we say, on a state level, state by state level, Supreme Court decisions and stuff, and now is you know, essentially legal in so many parts of this country in sports, and we're now already seeing some of the first nibbles of untowardness, shall we say, in the NFL and other pro sports too. How do you feel about gambling? I mean, I sarcastically say, what could go wrong? But here's evidence from the earliest days of the professional version of the sport of what could go wrong.
It's a great question and so timely, because our whole lives until the past few years, I mean, it was viscerally, you know, felt by pretty much everybody that gambling, you know, could always threaten the integrity of any game. Like, what would stop any game, you know, if it came out that any, you know, material important game was fixed? I mean, that would be disastrous, right? So and I think the root of all that was the 1919 Chicago Black Sox and Shoeless Joe Jackson and all that, that none of us were alive then, but I think we generally, the echoes of history informed us that that was a really bad thing, and that really hit baseball hard for a long time. It was probably the root of the fear of that afterward. I mean, even back to 1903, I discovered Cy Young in the first World Series between the Red Sox and the Pirates. He was on the Red Sox. He admitted that he was offered a bribe to, you know, lose a game on purpose, and he told the guy to, you know, get the heck out, or he'd bust his face up, in so many words. But like everything else these days, it seems like we've become desensitized to, you know, drugs, sex, you know, whatever, rock and roll, and gambling, that all of a sudden we have teams in Vegas that we'd never thought we'd have before in the proximity to the casinos. And we're even hearing about stadiums and arenas potentially having sports books in them. I think I heard the Capitals, I mean, we're going to thinking of doing that, one of the first, or Ted Leonsis and his mega group. So, and all of a sudden, college players, NFL players, at least on the football side, I'm not sure, I haven't heard anything, I don't think, on the baseball side, but betting, at least supposedly, on their own teams or on their own premises, which they're not allowed to do. I mean, what could go wrong? I mean, it's only a matter of time. You know, people think, well, they make so much money. What's even the, why would they risk their contracts? You know, but it's just human nature. I mean, to want the action, and still some, you know, it's big money. Some wealthy, crazy rich gamblers could you know, tempt a lower paid player with some ridiculous sum to impact again. Yeah. I mean, it almost seems inevitable.
Yeah. And it's also sort of that proverbial, you know, those who ignore history are, you know, are condemned to repeat it. And which is a bastardization of what the original phrase was, but these things happen in cycles, right? In history generally, and in sports particularly, these sort of ebb and flow. And we've seen this in our, informal investigation, if you will, over the last 7 years of doing this show, and just, you know, stumbling across sort of these themes and these stories, you know, big boys and their toys, right? This, as we get into private equity now, partial and whole ownerships of teams, and maybe now even investing in college sports at some point, as has been rumored. It's just sort of another version of that too, right? Big business, right? It's always been that since the beginning of time when baseball became professional, et cetera, right? So I don't know. I don't know. I'm not predicting doom and gloom here, but you know, you just expressed some of the earliest versions of this story, and it seems hauntingly familiar now.
And even on the cyclical nature of things, I think even in the boom and bust in the market and in the technology world, the dot-com bust, and you know, highs and dramatic lows and crashes, having been through a couple of these, even in my professional career as a business valuation consultant, it seems to me that it's because these things seem to happen about 20 years apart. The next generation hasn't learned the lessons of the past and they repeat them. So, yes, let's just watch it play out.
All right, a tip of the leather football helmet in the general direction of Greg Fisseri and for that conversation. The book is awesome, but before you get the book, you should go online and search up in the Sports Illustrated archives. I think it's si.com. There was an article done in 2012 by then Sports Illustrated writer Richard Hoffer that Greg was that provided some research for. It was an article called "The First Super Bowl." I don't know if it was in August of 2012, but you can just search it up online. It is the article that kind of sort of jump started Greg's, I guess, writing of this tome, which we've been spending the last hour or so talking about. And the article is centered on the 1906 rivalry and the games and the shenanigans and the betting and all that stuff that happened between Canton and Massillon that essentially was sort of the apex, and then all of a sudden the hard stop of professional football's growing opportunity until, as we've talked about, till about 1920 or so, when the quote-unquote NFL kind of got going in earnest, and for all intents and purposes, if you're the NFL, the official beginnings, if you will, of the professional football experience in this country, which we now know is not the case. And if you want to experience and understand the voluminous number of nooks and crannies of the, let's call it, the primordial ooze of what came before the National Football League, run, don't walk, to get a copy of this book, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. And that's not an understatement. This is truly a volume, if you're a sports fan of any kind and a football fan in particular. But you don't have to be a football fan. It's a very accessible book. It's rich in photography, a lot of it original photography from family heirlooms and boxes and stuff of Greg's and his family's. It's wondrous. It's a significant book. And you will learn a lot and just all kinds of interesting stuff, like indoor football games in Madison Square Garden in 1902. I mean, who knew? I mean, this is just fascinating stuff that it is. We are most thankful for its existence and for Greg creating it. Couple ways you can get it. Obviously, the selfish way for us is to go to our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. All you do is search up, as you might do for any episode you might be interested in, episode number 317, which is this one with Greg Fisseri. And you will find numerous links to Amazon, which will allow you and give us a few shekels of referral love in the process to get the book probably as quickly as humanly possible, given Amazon's existence in every corner of the globe in terms of its trucks and its drivers and all that kind of stuff. The other way, which is probably even better and, you know, gives Greg more direct love and importantly so, is to go to his website. And that's gridironlegacy.com. Gridironlegacy.com. That's where you find out all the promotional stuff that Greg has been and will be doing for this book, and you can order directly from him at that site. and get him to sign it for you, which he was kind enough to do for me in a promotional manner, but you can do it for yourself. And I'm sure he will be most appreciative of that sale directly. He doesn't have to share any monies with Amazon or any other reseller for that matter. So by whatever means necessary, get this book. You will not be disappointed. You will be awed at its goodness upon its receipt. And I guarantee you will find it hard to put down. And I bet you'll be referring to it. Again, if you're a sports fan or somewhat passionate about football in some way, shape, or form, you will certainly learn a lot either way. You'll be glad you did, as they say. Let's see, what else? While you're online, you can write down, jot down, and send us a note of email goodness if you'd like. By all means, we're at hello@goodseatsstillavailable.com. Again, the website, goodseatsstillavailable.com, that's where all of our old episodes will live and still live. If you find something or you want to search up something or whatever, of course, the best way is to just simply subscribe or follow us wherever you get podcasts. We're also available on YouTube. We stream the episodes on YouTube, so you can like scrape them there and create MP3 files if you like, or you just want to just listen and stream it that way. No great visuals or anything, but at least it's another way to enjoy and ingest the proceedings each week. You can follow us on social media. In probably order of intensity, I would say on Twitter/X, we are at Good Seats Still. On Instagram and Threads, you will find us at Good Seats Still Available. And a couple of whimpers of still usage there on Facebook at Good Seats Still Available as well. Our thanks to Jerry Payne of Jerry Payne Audio Excellence. Thank you, sir, as always, for your kind knob twiddling this week. And thank you, kind listener, for listening. As always, we appreciate it. And until next week, we will see you. Take care of yourselves and don't bet too heavily. See ya.